Cherry Developer News, episode number 53 for Monday, July 29, 2013. I'm Ken
Rimple. I'm Joel Confino.
And we're here to talk about all the things tech before I go on vacation. Hey! One of the things, Joel, let's do your first one we were laughing at as we came to the cold open.
Sure. So on Twitter, at Matt Russell UK put on a funny but true post, which is, hey, Scala soon to be a more sought-after skill than COBOL. So if you go into indeed.com/jobtrends and you type in Scala and COBOL, you can see Scala is actually trending up a little bit, and then COBOL is trending down,
right,
even though it still has more totals. But then kind of the kicker to that is then somebody replied, now, if we can only compete with pizza, that's a growth trajectory. So if you throw in pizza, so on job trends, you do Scala, COBOL, and pizza. Pizza jobs just absolutely obliterate Scala and COBOL. So pizza's just going absolutely vertical. That's where the money's at.
A lot of pizza eaters at the beginning of 2013. It must be election fever or something. I don't know.
Yeah, hopefully it doesn't mean the economy's bad and the only thing you can get is pizza delivery now. A lot of programmers out of work.
Yeah, I see a lot of drop right after that big hit, too. That's too funny.
That's the Super Bowl effect, man.
So we will clearly put the one that includes pizza in that dev show show note because it's required. Okay, cool. So let's start off here. PhoneGap 3.0, our own Don Coleman, on blog.chariotsolutions.com, put out a post, I guess yesterday or today, Thursday, about PhoneGap 3.0. And it was a PhoneGap day in Portland, Oregon, sometime last week. And so he goes over what PhoneGap is releasing. Now, quoting Don, prior to 3.0, PhoneGap was distributed as an archive, which was downloaded and unzipped to install. Now, both PhoneGap and Cordova are distributed as command line tools, which are installed via Node.js's NPM, which will make it a lot easier for me to remember how to install it. Let's see, he said, the Cordova distribution provides the core functionality to embed a web view, a browser, onto a native application. So I think Cordova is like the open source, and then PhoneGap is the commercial, whatever. And so, for example, he says, you distribute this Cordova install, just basically do the base web view in the native app, and then you can install the functionality you want by adding a plugin. So the example he gives is if you want to add the camera API, you do Cordova, which is the command plugin add, and then the URL for the Git repo to the camera plugin. So making it easy for you to like load in different plugins, and he references a blog post for that. This is how he references it. So PhoneGap is a distribution of Cordova, similar to how Safari and Chrome are based on WebKit.
So that's
the way that works. And the PhoneGap would be Cordova and all the core plugins installed. So he has examples of that. Anyway, so there's a link on there. PhoneGap 3.0 is released, and you can kind of find your information there. So that's item one. All right, next up, Java EE 8 wish list. I figure you and I could have some fun with this. Let's browse that page.
Yeah, let me check that thing out.
Yeah. So this is on DZone, and by Antonio Goncalves, I believe this is the right name for him. Agoncal, A-G-O-N-C-A-L on Twitter. And so he had a blog post in 2011 about what he wanted to have in Java EE 7. 7's released, and some of his wishes are fulfilled, he says. People are writing books, and it's time to start thinking of Java EE 8. Gulp. And that was my editorial. And so he started putting together a list. Now, just forgetting everything else, I haven't been paying as much attention since I've been such a spring nut to Java EE. I've noticed that they've gotten a lot thinner, a lot simpler to work with, but they still have those different profiles, and EJB still exist, and they have to be in a container, I believe. There's like lightweight ones, but you still have that. Let's see what he has in his list here. And then I'm thinking about all the things that Spring has that I might use that just might actually already be there.
Yeah.
So let's see here. We've got testability. Now, I know that for testability, Spring has a beautiful little testing container tool. You know, you just basically run with the Spring JUnit 4 runner. I guess testability, I know there's a tool for that in that JBoss put together. I'm never going to remember the name of it. But anyway, that you can run basically as a container in your tests. Let's see here. You want me to make that bigger for you?
Yeah, where's testability?
Bottom.
Ah, there we go. Sorry, I missed it.
Like every test, it's at the bottom.
Yes.
I didn't say that. Yeah. CDI. So I know CDI is their dependency injection framework for Java SE. And I guess what he's saying is CDI must not have, if we scroll down here a little bit to the actual discussions, in Java EE 7, I'm quoting him, has spread into several specifications, JSF scopes, JTA transactions, used CDI's interceptors. But it's saying that in Java EE currently, there isn't really a way of doing a simple embeddable profile with a minimum number of services. So in other words, you need something to kind of give it a simple platform that everyone can use without injecting an entire EJB container.
Agreed. I think that is big. Also, that testability one is actually big, too.
That's huge.
That's a big flaw that Spring has solved, that Rails has solved.
And Arquillion is the one that they're talking about there. Right. Exactly. So, yeah. I mean, I don't know enough about it to be more than crazy. If you're out there, and I'm trying to find out who's out there listening to this Dev News podcast, because we're just building it back up again, and we would love to get feedback. We'll read it on the air. So tell me what you think of this blog post.
I mean, we can't read the curse words, but other than that, yes, we can.
And also, he mentions things like standard artifact repositories. He also has templating, right? Can we use JSPs instead? And can we do something like, you know, TimeLeaf and things like that, standard templates? Templating for emails, you know, things like Velocity, so you don't have to install things. Okay. So anyway, so read that, see what you think. I can't believe we're going to be starting to talk about Java EE 8.
And actually, in the comments, there's some good stuff. Somebody actually has their own list, which I would kind of think is good. General security framework, that's a huge one.
Yeah.
Caching, that's a huge one. Templating inspired from somebody else, I think is what he means. Haml is a great templating framework.
Yeah.
JSP is a horrific one.
Yeah,
so, you know, the only debate, and I know this is going to open up a can of worms, but is JE really so bad that it's worth saving, or should we really just punt it? I mean, I just don't see, you know, I know the folks at Red Hat are doing a lot with it and are actually trying to do a lot of work to make it better, but it really just seems like it should be killed off. And I mean, servlet is great, but there's so much other parts of it that, you know, as somebody who's lived through EJB2 and, you know, all these things.
It's a lot better than it was.
Yeah, personally, I just have no interest in going back there.
A multi-tenancy support, that would be a good one, but
interesting. I can't quite see how that would,
I'm not sure,
would be generic sized.
Yeah, whenever you throw stuff like that in, it's like you really have a particular solution you want to solve, not necessarily a generic framework to apply.
Right, and I think the generic framework part is what killed JE, rather than picking a few specific things, trying to be this be-all, end-all enterprise solution thing.
And I know we're biased, but I mean, to some degree, but not even so, because both of us have worked with different technologies than Spring, you know, and our development company here works with things like Rails and a whole bunch of other things. And so we've seen when a platform is simple enough to work with, it's easy to onboard people, it's easy to maintain, it's easy to write code, easy to test code. That's what you're really striving for. So
I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, complexity kills, and I don't think JTE has ever been a simple solution.
Okay. Hey, if you want to yell at us, because you can, I'm going to say it again, at TechCast, please don't be mean. But then again, we did say we should just kill Java EE just now, so I guess you could be mean.
Except for servlets.
I
like servlets.
That's right. You know, hey, no one's ever stopped me. Anyway, so let us know. Give us some feedback. We'd love to hear it. And or I'd be on a long vacation instead of a 1 week one. All right, what's next here? Do you want to talk about the credit card attack by high-tech cyber criminal gangs?
Sure. So it was, you probably have seen in the news, it was all over the news, 160 million credit cards hacked over the past decade by this high-tech criminal, cyber criminal gang. They, you know, I guess different security agencies have been after them for a while, and probably one of the, if not the most successful / destructive hacking groups ever. So, you know, that's not a ton of news that there's hackers out there stealing stuff. Kind of what was humorous in this, though, if there is humor, and probably not that much humor if yours is one of the companies that got attacked, but is that, you know, all over the news there were these quote-unquote high-tech cyber criminal gang and blah, 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 and they were very successful in their, you know, evil endeavor. Their main technique, some kind of amazing new technology involving quantum physics and a DeLorean? No, SQL injection, folks. SQL, you gotta be kidding me.
Oh my God.
And you know what I found is if you read the article, you know, they did hit some high profile targets, but then they found all these credit card middleman processors that were sort of not as big, maybe didn't have as much security, and apparently were using unescaped SQL Which, you know, it's like, folks, seriously?
Hear me out here. If you are building your SQL statement from a string with pluses, you should cut your fingers off right. and put them on the desk and have someone else type for you who knows it, because it's bad.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you're doing it and you're substituting them with an API that checks to make sure they're encoded properly, step one in the right direction.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So, oh my gosh. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a biggie. Yeah. You know, it's funny, but because I think it was years ago, back in the DBA days that I had back in the 90s, people did the same thing. They opened up a SQL Server client tool set, and SA is, okay, don't try this at home. The SA is the system administration user. And by default, SQL Server was defined to have the password to be nothing. So they would hook up and say, you know, www.whatever.com, and they would connect to that with SA and no password. And they got online, which is bad enough, which means your database is hosted in your web tier, which should send alarm bells screaming. And then they were able to actually get in and do whatever they want with the data.
Wow.
Scary.
Yeah, and these guys actually hacked NASDAQ, believe it or not. I mean, they got some big names.
They got some big names, yeah. And, yeah, don't buy a big gulp and with a credit card. I'm just kidding. Probably not now. But, wow, that's pretty scary. 10 years of that, and they were finally caught. What actually got them brought down, though?
You know what? I failed to remember that part, but there was a famous case about like a year ago, which they have in there, which basically the ringleader or the, you know, kind of the leader of this pack was caught and brought to trial. And now, but I guess here they're actually picking up, you know, portions of the rest of the gang, although there still are people, you know, who are withstanding.
Wow. Yeah. Just reading through here. That's a good one to put in my pocket reader. All right. Awesome. Hey, you like war stories? So let's go take a look at a war story from Twilio and Redis. So this is a failure that happened, an ops war story. So let's go here. It's from antares.com/news/60. By the way, we'll put all these up on the Dev News website, which is emergingtech.chariotsolutions.com. If you go to the podcast menu item, you'll find the Dev News, and you can find this article and find all of our show notes. But we'll take a look at this one. And it's a Twilio incident involving Redis. Now, I'm not sure I can really get this all summarized properly, but I guess I'm going to start off by saying I consider people who do this kind of forensic analysis of what they did wrong and then share it with people invaluable,
mm-hmm.
Especially when that whole S3 failure happened about a year and a half ago, it was 2 years ago or something, where there was a problem where they couldn't get the S3 connection to Elastic Block Store. There's something about Elastic Block Store volume going down, and then to do a replication, there was a mass storm, and no one could connect up. And as this stuff was happening, I forget if it was Netflix or someone was blogging about everything they were learning. Anytime someone does this, I think it's A, it's brave, and B, I think it really helps the rest of the community out.
Totally agree. And Anti-Res, the guy, whoever his real name is behind Redis, he's really humble. Well, for one, he's really smart, but he's also, he will blog stuff like this. He will take opponents who have, you know, things against Redis, and he'll make it public, and it just really has an amazing attitude.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So yeah, so his first statement is that Twilio uses Redis, and so his point was, the first thought is, well, Redis is an in-memory system to save balances. So his statement is, so everyone will say, WTF, Twilio, are you serious with your data? And his point is, well, actually, Redis uses memory to serve data, but the incident has nothing to do with durability of Redis as a database. And they were using an append-only file as a durable solution to back the data that they're serving in memory. So he references that in a blog post. And so apparently, yet again, there's a replication system involved. So the replication issue was that Redis 2.6, in his statements, needs a full resync between a master and a slave after a connection issue happens, where you lose connection. Redis 2.8, fix the problem, but it's a release candidate. So Twilio really couldn't use that feature, and the feature that they added in 2.8 is called partial resync. And so the master became unavailable because many slaves tried to resynchronize at the same time. So it's like a synchronization storm is what happened there. That's what he's stating here. And he says, for the way Redis works, a single slave or multiple slaves trying to resynchronize should not make a huge difference since just a single RDB is created. And then the second slave attaches, and there's already background save and process, it's put in a queue. But Redis will use additional memory for many slaves attaching, and so basically it's filling up a lot of memory, I think is what he's saying here. And then he goes on and on. I'm not going to go through the whole thing. It's a very long blog article. But he goes in, and as you mentioned, he comes down with all sorts of tests. He shows you, like, you know, the actual pinging at towards the end for the resync process, and just really good information. So yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the rest of the. I'm not really familiar with him. So he's the creator of Redis. Is that who?
Yeah, Salvatore. And I have in the past followed him on Twitter. He's a really strong mind in distributed computing and
fantastic
and in-memory database stuff. And
read up on it, if you, especially if you do Redis. Hey, do you think there's too many patents in software, Joel?
Yes.
So do I.
Scares me.
Yeah, I'm patenting the key click. Can I do that?
I mean, I think there should be two things should be patentable, like the Linux kernel and TCP/IP, and like everything else, like, you know, you didn't invent it, so let's just forget about it.
Yeah, exactly. And then they can license every key click, 1 cent per key click. If I had that, I'd be rich. Your favorite guy, Joel on Software.
Joel Spolsky. I do like him.
I know you like him. So he has a nice one, Victory Lap for Ask Patents. So apparently, patent application US 2013-006-3492-A1, submitted by Microsoft. And so there's a service called, I guess, Ask Patent. And so let me see here. The patent was typically obfuscated, I'm quoting here, and used terms like pixel density for something that every other program in the world would call resolution. either accidentally, because Microsoft's lawyers were not programmers, or most likely because the obfuscation makes it that much harder to search by the patent office and by people looking for prior art. So he's basically saying that, you know, without reading too deeply, I realize this patent is basically trying to say sometimes you have a picture you want to scale to different resolutions. When that happens, you might want to have multiple versions of the image available at different resolutions so you can pick the closest one and scale it. Now, I don't think that's novel. I've done that with every web host I've ever uploaded an image to. Right? Like, do these various levels of thumbnails, and photography tools would do this too. So, yeah. So anyway, so he took about 10 minutes, took a look at it, if I'm reading this properly. So he has a full-time patent expert on staff. Of course, he writes software, right? Mika Siegel. And it said, the USPTO rejected Microsoft's resizing image patent. And apparently it took about 10 minutes to submit the prior art statement. What's the whole point?
Yeah, I think it's really cool because he said, you know, got 15 minutes, go to Ask Patents right now and see if one of these patents covers a topic you know something about and post any examples you can find, and most of them can be found on Google. So it's pretty cool. Like, if you're angry at the patent trolls, you can go spend 15 minutes and go quash somebody's ridiculous patent on rounded corners. Oh, wait, Apple actually already got that one. But
here's a good one. Geolocation. Providing digital content as promotion for check-in, eBay, patent application, prior art request.
Oh, you can't believe. I mean, I've been through here looking for some things. Hadle is a question and answer system, so looking at the patents on questions and answers, you know, like patent on someone has a question. What, you can patent that? I mean, like, you know, you've got to be kidding me.
I have an idea. Patent that. Right. No one can have an idea without paying me.
Right.
That's it. That's the way it's going to be. All right. Hey, here's another one. Let's see. And I think we'll leave on this. Since we're on a roll inflaming all sorts of concepts, this one's going to be a duck deeply and hope that we don't really offend, because we're not trying to offend. We're just trying to discuss more interesting articles around big data. This one is a New York Times Bits and Blogs article by Quentin Hardy. Again, I believe we read one of them a couple weeks ago that was kind of... calling into question big data. Also, Somni Sengupta. It says, big data analysis adds the guest worker debate. We have lots of data out there describing what the jobs are that are needed. I'm quoting from the article. Certain kinds of engineers are a source supply, I'm paraphrasing, in the United States. But there's lots of candidates for thousands of positions that companies want to import guest workers. And this was an analysis of 3 million resumes by a company called Bright. They correct resumes, and they use big data to sift through the resumes to find out what's going on.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. They were looking to lobby Congress for more temporary visas, H-1B visas, saying there's not enough qualified Americans. Its critics, including major labor groups, say bringing in guest workers is a way to depress wages in the industry. Let's see. Bright is based in San Francisco, and it makes money by placing qualified candidates with recruiters. That's part of their gig. And it employs workers using H-1B visas. So, you know, one of the quotes, the chief executive of Bright said, we're Silicon Valley people. We just assume the shortage, which is true. Turns out there's a little Silicon Valley groupthink going on about this, although it's not comfortable to say that. For a few job categories, I'm still paraphrasing and phrasing here, like computer systems analyst, Looks like for every opening, there were four openings for every American candidate, which means if you're going to do analysis, you could probably find a gig. For highly skilled computer programmers, there were more than enough in potential candidates in the United States as well. And I have that statistic right. Four openings for every American candidate. Yes. There are more than enough potential. Yeah, so anyway. So point being that they're using big data tools. They're analyzing whether or not it makes sense to open up the H-1B visas, which are the temporary immigration visas for temporary workers. And their feeling was that there was a big shortage. But of course, they're in Silicon Valley, where if you have the word programmer on a shirt, someone's going to pull you aside and say, would you like a DeLorean? You know, whereas it's not necessarily the same case everywhere in the world. So, you know, there could be localized things that make you form an opinion that you then apply to your analysis of big data, for example. Mm-hmm. Now, again, this is a pretty balanced article because it also comes back and says that doesn't shut down the debate. And it talks about different types of workers and what the visas were being used for. It's an interesting debate. I mean, we're talking about, you know, big data as a tool for digging through and analyzing, you know, trends. And now those trends can jump to anything you can suck into a system and process.
Yeah, and I guess, quickly. And I mean, there do seem to be, that is interesting. Because basically, I guess the point of this was somebody was trying to argue that, I guess, that there were a lot of job openings in lower level tech workers, but right. At the high end, there wasn't any kind of shortage at all. I think that's kind of the point.
I think that's right, but then when I read the sentence, it threw me off because he said there was four jobs for every one person.
Well, I think that they were saying that if you use the data in aggregate and you say, hey, we have a bunch of these computer jobs, basically, you know, to use it really generically, we have a lot of computer job openings, but if you take it one step further, you don't look at an aggregate and you parse it out, there's a very specific kind that we actually have a shortage for. And there's another specific kind that we don't. So maybe if you look at it too generically, you gather the wrong conclusions.
Yeah, yeah. You can even gather wrong conclusions looking at age of workers, too. There's the second to last paragraph of this is very interesting, that experienced American workers tend to be older, but we're in an industry that prizes youth. Mm-hmm. Right? That's a challenge because, you know, at some point, we've all been on projects where that you know, youth versus experience thing has come to play. And it's great when everyone collaborates, but when everyone doesn't collaborate, it can be very interesting to see what wins out.
Yeah.
But, you know, you wonder if companies in Silicon Valley are prizing young workers, they're going to look at a particular bias in terms of who would be an expert and maybe dig certain directions in terms of demographics.
Yikes, yeah.
Who knows?
It just said in the end, a study conducted by a company called PayScale found that among 32 technology companies, only 6 had a workforce with a median age over 35. At Monster, the median age was 30. At Google, 29. At Facebook, 28.
28.
Wow. And at Twitter, it was actually, the median age was actually 6.5. Can you believe that? Children. They're just children.
You can leave us feedback and add TechCast. Please, don't hurt me when I'm on the beach this week. All right. Well, anyway, so that about wraps it up for the dev news for today. I think we've inflamed the entire continent of America and others as well. Please, North Korea, do not bomb us. You can leave us feedback again at TechCast. You can send us email at TechCastFeedback@ChariotSolutions.com to subscribe to this and other podcasts or to watch our screencasts. Go to emergingtech.chariotsolutions.com. And so for the TechCast, I'm sorry, and also for the dev news is what we're doing right now. I'm Ken Rumpel.
I'm Joel Confino.
See you in a week.